semaine. If you look at the terminal, you'll see a bunch of stuff streaming by as it goes ahead and does that for us. And now you'll notice we've got exactly the same files listed in the file view here, but in the folders on the left, we've actually got a bunch of new folders. So we have rk044.zip, and now we have a folder representing rk044.zip, and we can click on that, and we can recurse inside that folder. So here's another example of the virtual file system. Let's have a look at some of these others. In the case of test.txt.gz, it's not an archive so much, it's just a single compressed file, and we represent just add the data as just, we just give it an arbitrary name. And this gives us, provides access to the data inside that file. You can see it's now using the gzip driver to retrieve the first element outside of this inode on the disk. This is a secret text file. And similarly, in this one we've got a zip file. We can have a look at the contents of the text file inside that zip file and do a string zone if you like. This is a secret sentence. So it looks like Tony's got lots of secrets on this laptop. Let's see what else, otherwise we can find these things. We know he likes marking his documents as secret, so let's do a keyword search for the word secret. I'll just return to the main menu and go down to the search index keywords. Our case is selected and our data source is selected, and let's search for the word secret. That's better. I think there's a slight race condition or something there. What this report does is shows us all the occurrences of the word secret inside all of the files in the virtual file system in PyFlag. If you have a look at the inodes over here, you can see that all of them, in fact, have at least one pipe character in them. That means the virtual file system is being invoked in every instance. So we can see data here. This is a secret text file. If we click on that, we'll recall that this was actually inside a gzipped file. And to give you an example of how this provides a lot of extra reach for us and allows us to find things we wouldn't normally find, I can give you a quick demonstration. Here's one I prepared earlier. That's the image, and let's just grep for the word secret in that image. You can see that we don't find a single occurrence of the word secret as raw data inside this image. So our virtual file systems and our file system scanning has provided a lot more reach into the depths of this computer file system. I'm going to return to the main menu now and give you a real quick rundown on a couple of the other features of PyFlag. One of the scanners we chose is virus scanning. Looks like it didn't find any viruses, actually. Sorry? Oh, didn't I? I may not have turned it on. All right. I can... Flag will never scan anything twice, so that all these other scanners that have already run won't be invoked again, and so this should be a pretty quick operation. And let's go back and try that again. And this time we can see that we've found inside a zip file, we've found this ntroot, which is our ntrootkit.zip, so we've found a virus. Other features include browsing Internet Explorer history. This scanner is invoked every time we find a file with the magic of Internet Explorer history file has a certain signature, and it's usually stored in the index.dat file in users' profile directories. And we can see a bunch of requests that have been made here, and we can filter those. Let's just filter on Google, and we can see all the Google searches that have been made by this user. And it looks like he's searching for Eddie. I think Eddie is Tony's brother. And he's been searching for Real VNC. Perhaps he wants to use Real VNC as a Trojan to sort of see what the Don's doing on his computer. Windows registry files are another special type of file that we extract every time we come across one. I won't go into much detail here, but you can see that we can navigate inside a Windows registry file and look for some sort of interesting key. And it's quite a huge sort of thing, the registry files. So a more useful interface is probably the table view. So we can search for arbitrary registry keys here, and there's, if you know where to look, there may be some fairly juicy information in the registry file. And finally, when we come across PST files, in addition to adding them to the virtual file system, well, we've also got a special report written here which allows you to view them in a slightly simpler manner. So we've got tabs at the top for the different components of objects you find in PST files, emails, contacts and appointments. See a bunch of emails and the contents here. I have a secret, do not warn Don Vito, from Michael Cohen. Seems you may be implicated here, Michael. And we contacts and so on. The last thing I want to show you is the MD5 hash comparison. I mentioned that this is quite a powerful forensics technique in real jobs because it can eliminate many files quickly. And what we see in this table is basically every single file name, and of course that includes virtual files, and we see their file type, and we see if they match, we see their MD5 sum at the end there, and we see if they match an NSRL product. So the typical scenario in which you would use this report is to load it up and then do a group by on NSRL product. And that gives you a quick sort of snapshot of what's installed on the system. So we can see there's some positively identified files from Windows 2003, Windows NT, a book maybe called Guide to Hacking Software, and the rest are unknown. So what we probably want to do is concentrate only on the unknown files. So if we click on that, this takes us back to the main hash comparison table, but it's filtered out all the known good files that have matched. And then maybe we might only be interested in, we may want to group all the files of a particular type, so we can click on that. And this shows us all the different types of files. And maybe we're only interested in executables. So we can add another filter there. And now we can see that there's one unidentified MS-DOS executable on the system. We can click on that and that tells us what it is. It's in fact that rootkit that we saw before. And you can click on the inode. It's another important feature of Flag is the fairly extensive cross-linking, so we can easily sort of data mine, if you like. Let's have a look. We know that Tony likes to take lots of photos of Linus in his togs. And let's see if, let's say, search for find all the file types which match the word image. And we can see a bunch of images here. These are the ones we saw earlier. One of these is deleted. I mentioned one of the file scanners is the deleted scanner. So when files are deleted from the file system, sometimes their metadata is still stored depending on the file system. When we come across those, we want to treat them as a virtual file system as well and relink them into the tree. And what we're doing in relinking them into the tree is ensuring that they're also subjected to all the same scanning, so we still identify their type and their hash and so on. So let's have a look at what's inside that deleted image. It's a picture. And it's a picture of Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. So could this place Tony at the scene of the crime? Let's have a look at the hex dump of this photo now. And we've got a bit of EXIF data at the top of this JPEG that tells us a little bit about the camera that took it. Seems that it was taken by a Fuji Finepix 3800, and we found one of these in Tony's house as well. And there's a date, what looks like a date here also, 2003 7:30. That's the 30th of July 2003. So it looks like we might have been able to place Tony at the scene of the crime when Don was shot down outside the Caesar's Palace. And that basically concludes the disk forensics demonstration of FLAG. And I'll talk really briefly now about some of the other developer features of FLAG which may be useful for the developer. So to summarise the disk forensics, we busted Tony. The scanners provide enormous reach into the file system, and we combine those with the virtual file system with how that's integrated into the core of FLAG. We can see that all the functionality that sits on top of FLAG, such as virus scanning, searching tables and so forth, all of that works on any file, whether it be virtual or a real file. And that provides a lot of power. I briefly want to talk about the framework that makes up FLAG. Basically, we have a concept of a report, which I'll go into a little later, and then we have a number of sort of APIs that programmers use to create, to build functionality in FLAG. And includes a basic database API and a user interface API. And we support easy cross-linking of reports. To provide new functionality, each of the things that we saw in the main menu here are called reports. So for instance, virus scan, that's a report. Each of these reports are what provide functionality to FLAG. And all you have to do to build your own new report is basically inherit from the base class, provide a couple of parameters that you require, and you describe the parameter's name and its type, so you can say it must be an integer or must be a string or whatever, and you give it a name, family and a description so that we can build the menus. Finally, you provide a couple of methods, form, analyze, progress and display. Form method is used to gather those parameters from the user. The analyze method performs any time-consuming analysis. It forks off into a different thread, actually. And so we separate the analysis from the display. Progress keeps the user informed of what's going on. And display is used to actually show the results to the user. And that's where we use the user interface API. The diagram explains it a little better. This is basically how the FLAG framework operates. We issue a report. And we check, the FLAG framework first checks if all the parameters have been satisfied. If they haven't, we keep printing out the form, and the form is supposed to keep prompting the user for more and more variables that it requires. As soon as those parameters have been satisfied, we look in the cache to see if that report's been done before, and what the report's name and its parameters makes that report unique, so if it's already been run, there's no point running it again. If not, we perform the analysis, and it's during this analysis phase that we try and do everything that's time-consuming and everything that we want to walk away and have a coffee instead of staring at the screen, and provide a progress report which updates the user. When the analysis is finished, then we move on to the display segment. user interface API in Flag provides quite a lot of power. We saw the probably the central sort of UI element in Flag is the table. It's easy to use. It's the table widget, and every time you use it, you get all those nice searching, grouping, filtering, everything for free. And some other APIs are the tree, the notepad, and the wizard, and we saw most of those during the demo. We can also add links inside. When we display our results, we can provide links to other reports. And provided that our link fills in the parameters for us, we'll never be prompted for the form. We can just skip straight to the display. Flag was written in Perl in its first incarnation, and it was big and ugly. So basically, you can see how the Flag framework is quite a useful tool for analyzing data quickly, and we can extend the forensics capability quite easily because we have a very modular sort of object-oriented design. And we found uses for the Flag framework, the table searching GUIs and stuff, beyond forensics themselves, and we've used it for a number of other in-house type applications as well. I'm going to really, really quickly show you one more thing. I mentioned that the user interface is abstracted in Flag. In addition to the web interface, we have a GTK interface. So let's have a look at a real quick look at our disk again. I think we called it LCA disk, Tony's laptop. So the reports don't care what the user interface backend is being used. They just say, I want a tree here, I want a table here, I want a toolbar button here. And the user interface backends, there's multiple backends. So this is one we've been working on recently, which is sort of alpha sort of quality, I guess, is a GTK interface. And some things are nicer, some things are faster in the GTK interface, so it's handy to be able to use that one when you need to. Click on a file, opens up in a new tab, still got all the same functionality, just looks slightly different. And that's the end. Is there any questions? Yes. The interface itself, basically the tables are all paged, so we only pull 50, or whatever the page size is configurable, work. Say we only pull 50 results at a time. Where you might see slowness is actually searching, searching a very large table, and so when, basically it all relies on the database. So if we can optimize the indexes on the database and try and search, do exact searches rather than likes and stuff, you can sort of speed it up. Typically, on the jobs we do, we've never really noticed it being slow, but there may be optimizations you can do to those tables to make everything work a little bit nicer. Yep. Pretty much. If you hang around for Michael's talk, which I think is up next, he's going to talk about RAID, and he may touch on how it's integrated into Flag as well, I think. Yep. So yeah, it does. The short answer is yes, we can operate directly on discrete disk images and rebuild the RAID on the fly. Yep. We don't have any support for that. I guess if you know the key and you can write a little bit of code, then yeah, maybe. Archive, in the, it depends on the, with zips you can still see the content, table of contents, so you can still sort of see what's there. I guess if the Flag interface itself doesn't allow you to supply a password and so forth, rather than looking in the virtual file system, you can just click on the zip file itself, save it off to disk, and then run password cracking tools against it. If you find yourself doing that a lot, then you could certainly write a scanner that tries to brute force the password or whatever. Yeah. that's true. Yep, sure. Yeah, that's the progress report that's being displayed there. And that progress report could probably be updated a little bit to make it a little more informative. Sure. Yep. Say that again, sorry. Thank you.
Servers, and it's in fact becoming much more common for workstation type machines. So RAID is supposed to offer us, you know, redundancy and fail-safe servability. But in reality, we find that a lot of the time, when the RAID system gets corrupted or has a problem, there is some significant challenges to recovering data from it, because the data is sort of sprayed across a lot of disks at the same time. So I'm just going to explain a little bit about what is RAID and what we might want to do to recover it. Basically, there are lots of different types of RAID, but three more common sort of types. RAID 0, which is just striping, has the data sprayed across the disk, basically in blocks. So one block is written on the first disk, the next on the next disk, and so on. And it's just sort of rotating around. That sort of arrangement gives us an increase in speed, because we're able to read and write from all the disks at once, but it doesn't give us any redundancy, because if we lose a disk, we're unable to recover the data that's on it. So that's RAID 0. RAID 1 is mirroring, and that gives us a lot of redundancy, because what we are actually doing is we are copying the data to all disks at once. So we actually have a copy of each block on all the disks. The advantage of that is that it gives us an increase in speed when reading from the system, because we can read consecutive blocks from different disks. Writing speed is the same because we still have to write the same block on all the disks. And then of course the capacity is reduced because the capacity is the same as the capacity of a single disk. If you need to recover a system like this, it's quite easy because if a disk fails, you can just use one of the other disks. That's quite trivial. So RAID 0, we can't recover any data if a disk fails. RAID 1, it's trivial. The one that I'm going to concentrate on today is RAID 5, which is a system whereby you can have parity spread across the disks. And the parity is actually the XOR operation of the same block on the other disks. So for example, in this case, we have the first block being written on disk 1, and the second block is written on disk 2. And then what we do is we write a parity, which is the XOR of 1 and 2, on disk 3. And then we can keep going like this. Now, if a disk actually fails, it's quite easy to recover the data that used to be on that disk by simply XORing the other two disks together. That will give us the data on the missing disk. And that's the case whether we lose the parity or the data block. And so the advantage of this system is it achieves a compromise between speed and efficiency. It's still quite fast. We are able to access N-1 disks simultaneously, so we've got an increase in speed. And also, we have a redundancy, as in we can lose one disk and we can still recover from that. So typically, we see systems, RAID 5 systems with three disks, five, six, seven disks sort of are fairly common as well. So why would we really care about the RAID? Why would we want to reassemble the RAID? Typically, a RAID, of course, is managed by a controller on board, and so it's quite transparent to the operating system. You can't see the operations that are taking place. But sometimes things go wrong. So, for example, when we do an image acquisition, we might want to reassemble RAID. If you're trying to do a forensic investigation against a server, for example, a 3-terabyte server, you would probably guaranteed have RAID. And so how do you actually take an image of a 3-terabyte server? How do you physically, copy every single bit in a reasonable time? It's just a logistical nightmare. Traditionally, you can try to boot the server off an OPEX disk and then image over the network, but a lot of servers, they don't have gigabit networks, only have 100 meg networks, and it could take a long time to copy, 3 terabytes over. Sometimes you get data recovery issues. The controller typically uses SMART to check the health of the disks in the array. Sometimes the disk might be sort of intermittent and it's sort of almost dying, but then the controller will actually detect that and mark that disk as bad and refuse to use it anymore. And so if that happens to a number of disks at once, the controller hasn't got enough data to rebuild the image, and therefore you sort of lose the array. But if you were to pull each of these disks out individually, you might be able to get data off them because they're intermittent, but you can sort of make it work. The problem then becomes how to convince the controller to actually use the new image instead of the original disks. Because controllers are proprietary, and the algorithms that they use to actually do this striping is proprietary, there is no way of working out how to deal with individual controllers. So what we would like to really do is to actually take the individual images and then through some process reassemble them together and create one big logical image of the original logical partition, and then we can recover the data off that. But because there's no standard, we have to pretty much do it our own. We have to reverse engineer the pattern for each controller because each controller is pretty much unique. Also, sometimes we actually get the disk out of the machine, and where it says disk 0, disk 1, disk 2, disk 3, they're not actually wired to the controller in that order. So you really don't know what the wiring order is on the disk. So you can pull a whole bunch of disks out, and you don't know which order they actually are supposed to fit into the pattern. So even if the controller is using a very simple map, simple striping pattern, you just don't know. So just before we start, I'd just like to talk about some definitions. And these are not necessarily in any sort of textbook or whatever. This is just the sort of definitions that I'm going to use when I'm talking about this. The first thing is a block, and I'll just refer back to the picture here, the diagram of the RAID 5 array. A block is simply a contiguous lump of data. And typically there are multiple powers of 2, sometimes 4Ks, sometimes more. I've seen blocks up to 64Ks. So they're just a lump of data. There are two kinds of blocks. There are logical blocks and physical blocks. A physical block is simply a block which is laid down on the disk physically. So for example, in disk 1, physical block 0 is that logical block 0. In disk 1, again, physical block 1 is, in this diagram, is logical block 2. And so there is a mapping between logical blocks and physical blocks, and that depends really on how the array is laid out. And so actually I'll just keep a bit, we call that a striping map, which is just the map between the logical blocks and physical blocks, and it allows us to find individual blocks. Also, this whole pattern thing repeats, you see, and so it keeps going. So once that particular pattern sort of is finished, then it starts again. And so that actually creates a period, and we talk about an array period as that as the number of blocks that it takes to repeat that same pattern. And so there is a physical array period and a logical array period, which again corresponds to the physical blocks and the logical blocks. So, you know, in this case, the array physical period is 3, and logical period is 6. So, yep. And so what actually happens is that when you consider a period in a repeated pattern, it's often useful to talk about a slot. And at least that's what I call it. A slot is simply location within that period that you're talking about. So slots get repeated, you know, each iteration of the period. So the whole trick about reassembling the array, so imagine you have a whole bunch of disks with data on them, is to determine those parameters, and then we're able to recover the data. So here's an example. There's three disks here. It's a RAID 5 array, and what you can do is you can simply look at the data one next to the other and try and sort of work out the block period, the block size, which is just the size of a repeated pattern. And I've got here an example, which I'd like to do. Start here. And this program is very simple. It just sort of draws the data one next to the other. And you can see there's a whole bunch of binary stuff in the middle. And once you get around then you can see some text. And text is quite useful because it's quite easy visually to work out where it starts and begins. And so we can see that, you know, there is a block offset there. And you can sort of read the text until you see sort of a discontinuity in the data. So it's possible to then tell how big the block is. Right, so once you know how big the block is, in this case it's 4Ks, you can actually specify that to the program, and what it will do is it will draw just the first top few lines and the bottom few lines. And so when we actually have a look at it, then we can see how the data is sort of continuing on from one block to the other. So here's an example, block 31. We've actually got some text there, and you can see the bottom of the blocks actually says href equals, you know, document, and then it actually goes up to the top of the block on the disk two, documentation. So it continues on. And so we can actually establish that one block follows another by this technique. So what we do is we actually okay, these are a few tips. I'll go back to that. So what we do is we just sort of have a look at this, and then we can see how each block sort of follows the next one, and which block is a parity within that set. And so we can actually draw the map, or we can work it out by first principles. That by inspection. So for example, how it says there, to include as many libraries as possible, so obviously, you know, that's block 0, that's block 1, because it continues on from that, and then it goes to index during scanning, So that moves on to that. So then on block 31, it keeps going down there, and so on. So you can actually draw a map of this, like this, where you've got 0, 1, 2. That was the parity, which is some random, it looks like random garbage, but it's actually the XOR of the first two blocks. And then 3 and 4 and so on. And you can actually keep going like that and build the map in this way. Just a few pitfalls to avoid. If you have one of the disks is 0, then of course the parity, the XOR of that with anything else is the same as the first thing. So it's really hard to tell the difference between the parity block and data block, because it's not random in that case. So just avoid that area of the disk, go to another area of the disk, And similarly, if you have random data, it's on the disk, it's hard to tell what's real and what's parity, what's just garbage and what's not garbage. So it's easier to go to regions of the disk that have lots of text on it. Another example is if you can actually find the dictionary on the disk, that makes life really easy, because you can just follow the dictionary, follow the words that are sorted alphabetically, and you can just see, which block follows which quite easily. So if you search for aardvark, it turns out that it's such a good word because it's only in a dictionary. You only ever find it in a dictionary. No one tends to sort of use it normally. And that will actually lead you to the start of a dictionary. And almost guaranteed you'll have a dictionary of some description on a disk, because especially even if it's a Windows disk, someone would have used Word or something, and it has a spelling dictionary on it. So that's there. If you look at user shared dicts, most people have user shared dict words and so on. And it's usually quite large, 900 kilobytes, and so it will span quite a lot of blocks, so you can actually do this thing. So anyway, so this is doing it sort of manually. Then it's quite important to try and recover the partition table, as a note, because you need to know whereabouts in the disk the actual partition you're interested in starts, and that's relative to the logical disk, but there's a certain offset where it starts. In this case, I just put this slide because in this example that I've got here, the partition table says that my Linux partition is actually located 63 sectors into the disk, which is quite normal for a Linux partition. So just wanted to remind people of that. And then I'm going to talk now for something completely different. I'm going to talk about something that's a little bit of a sidetrack, but it will join up a little bit when we actually talk about RAID in a second. And I think that Dave's already mentioned the PyFlag IO sources sort of concept. And the reality is that when we do forensics, we have a lot of images to handle. Like, we might get our images in different file formats. We might have a DD image. We might have it in an NCAS format. We might have a RAID set. All these are different file formats for images, you could think. And then there are lots of other different types of tools that we want to use on them. So, we might want to run the sleuthkit directly, or autopsy, directly on the images. We might want to run PyFlag on those images. We might want to mount it through the loopback kernel module. We might want to actually mount those images. We might want to do an MD5 sum, a file, to work out magic, hex edit them to see the, or hex dump them to see the hex dump. We might want to grab some pictures out of them or carve them out using a tool like XGrep or Foreman, or actually do strings on them. So there's a lot of different tools that we want to actually use on these images, but there's lots of different types of images. So really what we want to do is kind of put them together. What we want to do is be able to use any tool we would like on any image format we would like, and actually just do this sort of transparently. Now, a lot of those tools are actually open source, so we can actually theoretically grab the source code for these tools, open it up and patch them, and then so they can support all sorts of different types of formats, image formats. But that's really hard because you have to maintain that. You have to maintain your patch, and when a new version of whatever tool comes out, you have to maintain that. So it's actually not a simple thing to do. So what we really want, and what will be really, really good for us, is to find a way that we can enhance the functionality of any tool we would like, arbitrarily, without knowing what tool it is, and without touching its source code at all, and change its functionality. So can we do this? That's an interesting challenge. So we had a bit of a brain dump about it, and we realized that we can use a technique called IO hooking, or library hooking, for that purpose.
So here's how it works. Imagine you have a program, arbitrary program. Here's an example of some source code here. We've got a program that does very simple stuff. It opens a file, it reads some data out of it, then it closes the file. So it's a very simple problem. I don't think you can get anything simpler than that. And what we want to do is we want to actually be able to intercept its library calls so that we can change it. We can change it to whatever we like. So here's an example of the normal flow of events. So up here, this is the normal operation. This is just how normally it works. So what happens is your program starts running, and then it calls the open system, the open library call in libc, and then that links into the C library. And then in the C library, it does some stuff, you know, checking whatever, and then it actually generates a system call, which is an interrupt AD into the kernel, and then it actually ends up calling the kernel with a system call that says, open this file for me, and the kernel returns a file handle and so on. What we're actually doing in this hooking operation is that we're actually able to insert ourselves in the middle before the program intercepts into the libc, and then the program thinks that it's opening the file. We can then just, you know, use whatever driver we want to change it and then give it some other file instead. You know, so we actually can handle all this sort of abstraction down here. We can convert the whatever image that whatever image format that we want into a logical straightforward DD image, which is a standard, and then the program will just use that. But it doesn't really realize that a lot of translations happening behind the scene to actually make it see that it's some kind of a straightforward DD image. So let's have a look at how this might work. There's basically a wrapper which sets some environment variable. We've got an LB preload which forces our library to be loaded before libc, and then we are actually able to trick the program into using one of the drivers which is set up by the hooker. So here's an example. So up here, this is, again, as was mentioned before, an N case. N case is a fairly common forensic package for Windows, but they use a proprietary image format. And as you can see here, we have a hex dump. We're trying to do a hex dump of an N case file, and we can see some kind of proprietary header type of stuff. And in fact, it's compressed, so we actually can't see any of the image at all that way. But what we're actually doing down below is we are calling the wrapper. We're telling it to use the EWF, the eyewitness format driver. And then we're actually telling the driver to open this file name, test.e1. And then we're actually going to tell it to execute this hex dump program. And we tell the hex dump program to open a file called foo. Of course, foo doesn't exist, but it doesn't really matter, because when hex dump tries to open this foo file, the hooker will intercept that call, will just go, oh yeah, okay, no worries, here we go, and it will just give it some pseudo file that it will just, you know, like to work with. And so it will just operate on this pseudo data, and up here we can see that there's actually the partition, that's the start of the boot sector of this image. So we can see that arbitrary programs can now start to handle arbitrary file formats depending upon the drivers in the hooker. So here's an example. What we can do is we can convert an N-case image. This is actually a big problem for people that do forensics in Linux, is that a lot of people give them like proprietary file formats, like N-case files, you know, from the Windows world, and they go, ooh, I don't know how to analyze this. Can you have a look at this? And it's a problem because this is not really compatible with the open tools that we have. So using the hooker, we are able to use... you know, we would like to convert this NKS format into a standard format, like a DD file format that we can use. So this way, what we can do is down here is we can actually tell the IO wrapper to again through the EWF driver to hook any access. This dash F actually specifies that any access to the file foo will be hooked. Other accesses will not be hooked. And then when DD tries to open the full file, it will actually get the hooked image, which is just the decompressed NKS image. Then it will actually open an out file, which will not be hooked at all because it's not hooked. And then the block size will be 64K, so it will just copy it along. And this command effectively copies the NKS
the contents of the NKS image into a DD image, so it converts from one format to another, which is a fairly simple one. And then when we did that, we had like these really cool ideas, and one of the ideas was like, why should the file system be local? Why should we actually just talk about opening local images, image files? You know, why don't we just start to have a remote file system, not file system, a remote subsystem? The idea was that basically what we could do is when a program tries to open a file, it can go, oh, I want to open this file, and then the hooker will hook that and go, okay, you know, if this program wants to open this file, and then talk across the network to a remote servlet type thing, and the servlet will just go, yeah, okay, no worries, here we go, we'll open this file for you and get the data across and whatever you want. So the program has no idea, it's actually talking across the network, it just doesn't know that. All this stuff happens transparently. So that's really cool because we're able to then deploy the remote servlet on remote machines. The remote servlet, of course, enables us to access the raw device directly, you know, and so we're able to use our local forensic tools on the remote system's raw device, right, across the network. That gives us the ability to because we're not going through the remote system's kernel for accessing files through the system calls, then if the remote system is rooted, as in it's got a rootkit installed, then we're able to actually see the raw device, because we're looking at the raw file system structures, it's extremely difficult for a rootkit to actually hide files that way. Okay, so that allows us to look at even hidden files that are hidden through a kernel level rootkit. Okay, so let's just have a look at this demo, because it's kind of cool. So what I've got here is I've got the... just for the demo's purposes, we are actually going through the local host, but this could be done over the network as well. And what we're actually doing here is we're calling the wrapper and we're telling it to use the remote system driver and we're telling it to use the 127 host with the user root. We're giving it the path to the remote servlet, to the servlet that we're going to invoke on the remote end. And then we're actually telling it to look at the raw device, which is the hard disk. In this case, it's HDC. And the MMLS is just a program that lists a partition table. So it just dumps the partition table out, and we can see that it gives us the remote system's partition table, and then what we can do is we can actually tell it to look at a particular offset within that partition table. So for example, this has got a Windows partition, this many sectors in, and we can use a tool like FLS to actually list that that partition. And again, we're telling FLS to open the full file, which doesn't exist, but doesn't matter. And you can see that FLS is actually able to list the remote file system, the Windows thing with all the extended attributes and all the rest of it. In fact, there's no difference really between using it locally. Okay, so of course the disadvantage is that it's kind of slow because of network latency, but it is actually workable. The other thing is, of course, we are handling a live system, so there's a possibility of rest conditions there. So this is the example that I went through. So back to assembling RAID. So now that we went on this tangent, what we want to do is we're going back to our RAID problem. We're trying to reassemble our RAID. So using the hooker, we're able to reassemble the RAID sort of dynamically. Instead of, like you mentioned that you took a 3 terabyte server, you took the images of, it had like, 14 disks, and you took 14 different images, 250 gigs each, right? And so you have 14 images, 250 gigs, 3 terabytes, and you think you come up with a map that you think might be okay, and so, in order to loopback mount it, you've got to reassemble it, so you might reassemble it. Using some tool, using your map and all the parameters. You know how long it takes to copy 3 terabytes? A long time, Even on a fast system, it takes quite a while. And then you realize that you stuffed it up and your map isn't quite right. So you screwed it up and it doesn't work. So then you have to go and redo the map and then do that again, and then recopy all the stuff again. It just doesn't work. So it's much easier to use the hookup to be able to reassemble the RAID on the fly. So the hooker has a driver in it that can handle the RAID system. Given all the right parameters, it can actually build the logical image as required on the fly directly. So here's an example. This is the same map that we came up with before. So we can actually rebuild it on the fly as required. So then someone said, oh, okay, so why do I have to come up with a map? Because if I screw it up, it's only going to cost me a second or something, So why don't I just keep guessing, I mean, that's an interesting solution to the problem, right? Instead of sort of figuring something out from first principles, we can sit there and go, let's guess. Oh, yeah, no, oops, wrong. Let's do it again. Oh, oops, wrong. And just keep guessing until you get it right. I did that at school and I still passed. So it does actually work. Given enough opportunities, it works, right? So that's a really good idea because it's a shortcut. It allows us to basically skip this manual sort of thinking type stage and then just move into a quicker one. So what we did is we wrote a script that has a whole bunch of libraries of different maps that we've seen around the place. And just guess them, and that actually works remarkably well. What we need is a program that tells us whether what we guessed is actually correct or not. And so what we are using in this case is we're using a command called fls, which lists the files on the file system. So you can imagine, for example, that if I get my RAID map is actually wrong, then I'm not going to get very much when I try to list the file systems, because it will look at the data structures and then just completely get lost because it's just full of garbage. And so I won't be able to list many files. So what we're doing is we're actually counting how many files the FLS program actually pulls out, and then we're able to deduce from that what is kind of the best fit. So as you can see, I'll just bring that command line up again. What we're doing is we're running our RAID guess program. We're specifying a 63 sectors offset, as we detected before from the partition table, 4K block size, and there's three slots, so we assert that the period repeats every three times, and that's quite common for a three-disk array. And basically, when that happens, it sort of tries to run all these the FLS program with lots and lots of different types of maps. You see types of maps and you see the maps up there and the order of the disk, it sort of commutes that around. And you can see that for most of them, we actually don't get very many files at all. We get zero lines, like it just doesn't work because FLS goes, hey, that's not a file system, that looks all screwed up. But as you can see, sometimes it actually works a little bit. And so we can see up here, we actually produce three lines of data. So that map is kind of almost there, but it's not quite right because it actually sort of gets lost after that. So if we just keep going like that, we can see that this particular one produced 55 lines of data there, and then this one actually produced quite a lot, 186 lines of data. So we just get the best one, and that's basically it. So that gives us the right map, and it's the same map as we had before. So actually, it's interesting because when you actually run this against a real file system, there is actually a huge difference because the real file systems have lots of files in there, usually several hundred thousand files, and you'll see that it will go found 200 files, find 300 files, and then it will say, found 300,000 files. It's pretty obvious you got the right sort of map that way. So that's good because it allows us to be lazy, and being lazy is good. Okay, So we can actually use the hooker then to run this and give us the virtual file system. We can actually use DD to copy that out into a huge file. Now, the last time that I actually did a 3-terabyte file, if one of the disks is dead, the driver will automatically reassemble that from the parity. So when you actually take the images, if you don't have enough time, if you don't feel too inclined, you can just not take one image. That's okay. sometimes there's a header at the beginning of the partition, and the headers are usually storing sort of proprietary RAID stuff. And so sometimes, quite often, you'll have a partition table that looks like this. It will have the primary partition table at the beginning of each disk. It will actually say, okay, you know, with the hibernation partition, it's text, it's bloody huge, it spans the entire disk, in fact. And you won't actually be able to see any real data. And that's because what happens is the partition table, the header, is actually proprietary RAID sort of information, and the controller actually stores in it sort of configuration type data. But the real partition actually starts inside that. So quite often it sort of pays to sort of do something like this, where you can actually sort of try and search for the partition table somewhere along the disk, you know, somewhere inside the disk, and that will tell you how big the header is. So that's a quick shell script here that sort of uses the IO wrapper to sort of just specify an offset into the disk, run the MMLS program, which again shows, just prints out the partition table, and it basically just runs through and it guesses, tries to find some kind of a valid partition table somewhere in the disk. So that's a useful one. Now, the last time I tried to actually do that, to copy a, you know, so I had like a, you know, a 3 terabyte sort of image, I had, 14 images, so, which I needed the 3.5 terabyte, storage to actually store the images somewhere, and then I had to, and then I reassembled it, got the map out, and then I said, okay, you know, I want to loop back map this, but I don't have another 3.5 terabyte, you know, storage to actually rebuild this array onto, so I can loop back mount that thing, right? It would be really cool if I could just hook the kernel, so that the kernel would be able to see what the rebuilt RAID image, like the hooker. But as you would have already found out from before, we are hooking the library, the C library, in the previous example. So because the kernel doesn't really go through the C library, then you can't really hook it just in the same way. So it would be really nice to be able to hook the kernel, use its own loopback driver, and then we can use its file system drivers to be able to mount the reconstructed image. Now, because I'm not really a kernel hacker, I sort of thought about doing this in kernel space, and it would have been a good idea, but it would actually be a pain in the ass, because when you're writing kernel modules, Rusty would know about it more than I do, you don't really have access to the C library, or in fact any libraries, so you really have to be self-contained, which is quite hard, and certainly you can't really write it in Python. So so we thought, we need a system where we can actually write kernel stuff in Python, which doesn't sound as crazy as it's not quite as crazy as it first sounds. Anyway, there's a really cool project called Fuse, which actually stands for File Systems in User Space, and that allows us to actually write a file system driver in user space, in Python, in fact. So that's really cool, because we're able to then hook the kernel through the user space program. So this is a bit of a diagram of sort of what happens. It's a bit, it's kind of a bit convoluted, but it sort of makes sense when you sort of look at it. So imagine our program here is trying to open this this file, right? So it wants to open a file. It says, okay, you know, I want to open a file. So it calls the C library's open function like before, but now we're not intercepting that. We're letting the C library do its own thing. So the C library goes off and it says, yep, okay, you know, this program wants to open this file. It actually issues a system call to the kernel, and then it says to the kernel, open this file for me. And the kernel says, yep, no worries at all. Where the hell is this file? So it doesn't know where it is. So it looks inside the VFS switch inside the kernel to work out which file system it's actually mounted on. And the VFS switch actually uses a driver, a file system driver, to actually recover that file. So the driver is the Fuse driver. And so now the Fuse actually makes a call out into user space again, into a Fuse library down here, to actually work out what file it's supposed to be opening. And then the library actually makes a call into a Python program, no less, to actually work out what file it's actually supposed to do, which is the hooker. And then the hooker does all its magic, presents a pseudo sort of image, the same sort of idea, goes back into the Fuse library, goes back into the kernel, opens the real file on the kernel file system driver in the real partition, and then that all sort of goes back and forth. And in the end, the program just thinks that it's opening a file on a disk. It's actually opening something that doesn't even exist. It's not really there. So let's have a look at this. This is a very cool example. Pardon? No questions?